You were listening to Money on the Left, a monthly interdisciplinary podcast that reclaims money's public powers for imaginative, intersectional politics, proudly presented in partnership with Monthly Review Online. I'm Billy Soss with Scott Ferguson. We speak this month with Mark Paul, assistant professor in the Blostein School of Planning and Public Policy at Rutgers University and author of The Ends of Freedom, Reclaiming America's Lost Promise of Economic Rights, out recently with University of Chicago Press. In that book, Paul scours U.S. political and economic history in order to recover, reclaim, and adapt the rhetoric of economic rights for our current political moment. For too long, Paul demonstrates in the book and in our conversation today, progressives and leftists have let conservative and sometimes charismatic economists define the boundaries of our economic and political thinking. This, even as the left has underappreciated its own rich reserves of heterodox political thinking and radical rhetorical action. Hence Paul's outspoken advocacy within and beyond the book for durable and democratic policy interventions like Medicare for All, a federal jobs guarantee, and of course, a Green New Deal. It was a pleasure speaking with Mark, and we encourage listeners to check out his book, The Ends of Freedom. Thanks to Emily Emma Reynolds for this month's amazing graphic, to Mike Lewis for the transcripts, and to Nanning Kula for the theme tune. Please support our podcast and other projects by joining our Patreon, which is linked to in the show notes.
Mark Paul, welcome to Money on the Left.
It's great to be here today. Thank you so much.
So we've invited you to talk to us today about your very important new book, The Ends of Freedom, Reclaiming America's Lost Promise of Economic Rights, which is out from University of Chicago Press. And we want to get into a discussion about the book. But before we do, maybe you can tell our listeners a little bit about who you are, your background, your training. You've certainly studied and worked with all kinds of interesting folks along the way. So maybe just give us a little bit of a flavor of where you're coming from.
You know, when I was born, I wanted to be a PhD economist, and here I am. No. You know, when I was younger, I wanted to be a chef. I loved food. I grew up on DiGiorno pizza and Dino Nuggets, and it was terrible. And I thought there had to be something else to life. And thanks to public programming, good old PBS, Julia Child taught me how to cook. And so, you know, I watched Julia Child and just fell in love with food and, you know, worked in kitchens throughout high school, ended up going to culinary school and working in kitchens more. And it was my time working in kitchens and thinking about our food system that actually got me interested in economics. So, you know, I spent just years working on the line in hot, semi-miserable conditions, but in fairly high-end restaurants. And I'm working on the line next to often immigrants who've shown up for work every single day, year in and year out, and they are making marginally above minimum wage. You know, this is you know, 15, 20 years ago. But still, you know, they're making under $10 an hour in most instances. And it, you know, dawned on me that they nor I could ever afford to eat in the restaurants we're sitting here cooking in. And that is just messed up. What's going on here? And further, you know, my love for food got me interested in gardening and farming a little bit. And so I started, you know, down that path. And next thing I know, I'm reading about climate change and the climate crisis. And I'm sitting here, you know, as a you know, in my early 20s thinking, like, how screwed up is this world we've built? And I you know, from there, I guess, made for some people a rather large leap, but to economics. I mean, it's 2008 struck. All of a sudden, the economy comes crashing down. I start reading about the economy and I realize, you know, the food system is the way it is. You know, people are paid shitty wages and our food is, you know, good food is expensive where, you know, Captain Crunch is essentially free because of poor economic policy. And in fact, I realized we can choose different economic policy. And that set me on my path to becoming a PhD economist. It's not what I ever thought I would do. But here we are, you know, and it was really my kind of passion for food and my observations in the real world that you know, set me on this rather strange path to pursuing a degree in economics. But I came to economics not because I love studying economics. I came to economics because I wanted a decent world where everybody could afford to eat good food and people who worked on the line of kitchens didn't have crappy jobs, dangerous jobs, and low-paying jobs.
Can I ask, how did you find heterodox economics? I mean, one can have a desire for a more just, abundantly provisioned world, and then think, well, this is probably a problem of economics. And then when you go to research, well, how do I learn about economics? You know, the main pathways are the orthodoxy. So how did you find an alternative? I mean, what was that process like?
How did you end up like not self-blaming, right, for not having access to those restaurants and being able to pay for the swordfish plate?
It's such a good question, right? I mean, if only I had worked harder, if only I had worked 80 hours a week instead of 60 hours a week, I'd be able to afford a decent meal. No, but, you know, in all seriousness, it in part was luck. And it was in part just the books I happened to pick up. So Milton Friedman, Free to Choose, first economics book I ever read. And I finished it. And I thought, this guy is absolutely insane. this is not the world I think we want to build here. I mean, what's funny is, you know, I think most people agree with Milton Friedman. We truly want to be free to choose. But the type of policies he talked about is not what get us to a world where we actually have meaningful and real choices in front of us. And so, you know, reading Milton Friedman left me scratching my head thinking, this is crazy. You know, what else is there? And next thing I did was I picked up a book by Keynes and read that and was like, oh, this is pretty interesting. But the real look happened was that I'm from Massachusetts, and the University of Massachusetts Amherst is the premier heterodox alternative economics program in the country. And when I applied to colleges, you know, I had went to culinary school, but, you know, and I was taking some part-time classes in community college, but I didn't have money to pay for college. I was on my own financially. And I applied for a number of schools, and UMass Amherst gave me free education. And I said, you know, you can't beat free. Plus, hey, they have some interesting people in their economics department that are a little wonky. And so I went to UMass Amherst as an under, you know, to finish my undergraduate degree. And from there, I just never looked back. I was really lucky to be mentored by a host of amazing progressive economists, from Nancy Fulbright to Sam Bowles and Jim Boyce and others, who really opened my eyes to the fact that we can build an economy that works for the people rather than just working for, you know, the 1/10th or 1/100th of 1%ers that get rich at all of the rest's expenses. You know, it really, really was a once in a lifetime opportunity to go to a place like that and study economics.
You've also done some work with Sandy Darity. Is that something that you can talk about a bit with us?
Yeah. So, you know, in 2015, I was finishing my PhD and I started doing some writing with Sandy Darity and Derek Hamilton, two, you know, absolute luminaries in the field that have just done phenomenal work in, you know, advancing economics as a profession and also bringing economics into the policy space to, you know, demonstrate how it is that we can build a more just and inclusive economy. And so I had the wonderful privilege to go spend 2 years at Duke University working with Sandy Darity as a postdoc. And I do want to say here, I'm a K through PhD public school kid. I deeply believe in the public school system. And my 2 years at Duke let me see how the, you know, it's tempting to say how the other half lives, but it's how the 1/10th of 1%ers live. You know, it was really an amazing change in so many ways. But my time working with Sandy just really helped further my intellectual development, my belief in stratification economics, my study of economic history in particular, which I really bring into the book, where I look at the fact that, you know, kind of the neoliberal order that we like to talk about so much, you know, isn't the only way to organize the economy. And more importantly, it was an incredibly radical vision that came about, you know, and we can talk about this later, in the 40s and 50s. But my time with Sandy helped me, you know, really develop into the scholar I am today as I, you know, had the chance and freedom to just read far more wide-ranging texts, you know, folks like Du Bois, who I had never read before, and others that helped me, you know, broaden my horizons as a political economist. I don't just study economics. I study history. I study philosophy. I study political theory. And if we want to have a true holistic vision of the economy, we need to, you know, go beyond reading the American Economic Review, which has many important articles, don't get me wrong, but it's not going to help us actually shape a proper vision for where we want to go and why.
K through PhD, I like that a lot. K through PhD public school, similar here.
Me too.
Yeah. You end up at UMass Amherst, which is just a wonderful accident, coincidence, providence, a heterodox school. And then you work with Sandy Darity. I guess one question is what was your sort of interest in your dissertation? Because I imagine that anticipated your collaboration with Sandy Darity and Derek Hamilton. As you were going into your postdoc, they must have liked what they saw or knew of your work at that point. So talk to us a little bit about that experience at Amherst and the shaping of your, you know, intellectual foundation and sort of platform from which you sprung into this wonderful collaboration.
Yeah, it's a great question. So the ends of freedom actually isn't really that related to my dissertation. In fact, the ends of freedom is really new work. A lot of that work that came out of my time working with Sandy, as a matter of fact, where actually Sandy, Derek, and I co-wrote a piece for the American Prospect magazine calling for an economic bill of rights back in 2018. And that was kind of the predecessor to the book. So, you know, my relationship with Sandy really came out of actually my involvement in the 2016 Bernie Sanders campaign. At the time, you know, my dissertation was essentially done. It's three essays on sustainability, where I was really focused on the climate crisis. I should say here that half my work is really focused on causes, consequences, and potential solutions to inequality. And the other half of my work is really focused on addressing the climate crisis. Now, of course, the two are inextricably linked, but you know, they are two slightly separate buckets. And so the dissertation focused much more heavily on the climate crisis and what to do about it. And you know, really through this work, I came to, you know, understand that, first of all policy is climate policy. And second of all, and when we address the climate crisis, it's going to be a substantial reorganization of economic activity. And we have a choice here. And that choice is that we can allow, you know, policy to continue along the current fault lines of inequality, in which case we would most likely be deepening existing inequalities. Or we can be quite intentional about taking redistribution seriously, in which case the climate crisis actually presents an opportunity for us to fundamentally change the structures that exist within the economy and to address our both our emissions and our inequality challenges simultaneously. So the work with Sandy and Derek, though, really came out of my involvement in the Sanders campaign, where, you know, look, I had finished my dissertation, but I still had some time on my hands as a graduate student, and everybody's coming out swinging against Sanders for putting out radical proposals like Medicare for All, which was going to clearly bankrupt the country and make sure everybody, you know, quit their jobs, and $15 minimum wage, which would eradicate half of low-income jobs in America overnight. You know, they just disappear, and all these terrible things. And people were kind of starting to ask, like, you know, are these policies truly crazy, or, you know, is there some economic rationale for them? And at the time, you know, the kind of bench of progressive economists was incredibly thin. Of course, Stephanie Kelton was advising Senator Sanders, but there were very few economists that were out there kind of defending, I think, these very modest proposals that Senator Sanders was putting out. And so I decided to do a little bit of work with the campaign and to start writing, you know, both policy pieces and opinion pieces to kind of show the economic rationale for why $15 minimum wage, or, you know, programs to invest in higher education through making college free for everybody, or programs to actually make healthcare a human right, were actually economically smart. Now, it was this opportunity that really changed my work to focus on policy issues first and foremost, where I kind of became a policy economist. I, you know, still do academic work quite extensively, but what drives my academic work is the real world. It's thinking about policy issues and how is it that we can improve the economy and the functioning of it. And you know, therefore my academic work, you know, heavily ties into my policy work, you know, that it's kind of a two-way street, so to say. And it was through that work that I got to know Sandy and Derek quite well, and that Sandy was able to offer me a postdoc to come do some kind of additional research with him for 2 years.
Was the dissertation then sort of incidental or coincidental to or with the Sanders campaign, right? And or did it inform it direct your advocacy directly in any kind of way, do you think?
In economics, a dissertation, yeah, three essays on sustainability was the title of the dissertation. I mean, you know, look, in economics, a dissertation is three essays that you slap together, you write a quick introduction and conclusion, you call it a day. I mean, a dissertation is really about learning how to research. And that's what my dissertation taught me. I mean, it grounded me in economic theory. It taught me a great deal about economic and climate policy. I did a number of studies looking at kind of sustainable agricultural policy in particular, as well as sustainable responses to climate disasters. But, you know, the dissertation didn't dig into kind of the more pressing inequality policy issues that I ended up pivoting towards. The dissertation really taught me, how do I go about doing economic research? How do I develop my tools as an econometrician and as a policy researcher? And, you know, I published it all in academic journals, but it didn't necessarily go on to have a substantial policy influence the way that some of my later work luckily has, and the way that I hope that this book will moving forward.
So I have a question that I think you've probably begun to answer, but I had this written down, so I'm going to ask it anyway, which is, why a book? So when you and I, Mark, have had encounters in the past, we've hung out at conferences. You graciously invited me down to New College, where you used to be, to give a talk. I remember you kind of pondering aloud in earshot, you know, should I write a book? Should I write a book? And ultimately you decided to write a book. But that's not, as I understand it, that's not actually typical of what an economist does, right? That it's a kind of rarity. So I'm curious to hear, as we move to talk about this book and what it's really about, why did you decide not to write, you know, four journal articles? And why did you go for a book? And I guess a related question, or an integrated question, would be, who's your audience? Who are you imagining would read this? And of course, you know, I'm sure there's not just one answer to this, like X type of person, but I'm curious who you're thinking about your audience, and why you're deciding to take up the genre of the book.
I'm going to take those in reverse order, because the audience question is what drove me to write the book. So, you know, look, I've been privileged, and I've written numerous journal articles. And each time I write a journal article, I think this is going to change the world in some important way. And then, you know, maybe 100 people read it. It goes out in some academic journal where subscriptions are thousands of dollars a year. And it kind of dies in the PDF, you know, white paper ethos of the interwebs. And, you know, you hope that these journal articles change some academic minds, and in turn, maybe 50 years down the road, when those people are advising PhD students, you know, those students will read it, and it will change some, you know, the future generation. But, you know, I'm a little bit of an impatient person. I see the economy as it operates today, and it is screwed up. And I'd like to do something about that. You know, as Marx said, you know, the philosophers have only henceforth, you know, interpreted the world. The point is to change it. And that is indeed what brought me to the discipline. I want to change the world. I want to make the economy a better place. And so, you know, my audience is policymakers as well as the American public. So, I'm, you know, the book is aimed for kind of the New York Times, Wall Street Journal readership, ranging from Hill staffers to just, you know, interested voters. And I'm trying to, you know, here lay out an affirmative vision for a post-neoliberal world. We've all read dozens of books about neoliberalism's rise and fall, how it's either dead or on death's door. But what always drove me nuts about all those books was that they'd have 10 chapters about neoliberalism, and then one chapter at the end is, here's what comes next. And they just really quickly sketch out a few ideas. But, you know, if we actually want to move past the neoliberal order, we need to start envisioning what that would look like. We need to start envisioning what is the North Star that we are working towards. And so I set out to write an affirmative book that kind of discussed what the economy can and should look like post-neoliberalism. You know, what is it that we want? Why do we care about the economy? And what is it that we're collectively working towards achieving? Now, you know, why a book? With my audience in mind of changing the hearts and minds of the American public, and you know, and also I'm trying to change policymakers and Hill staffers, because, you know, I know we talk a lot about policymakers, but really it's the Hill staffers that have a lot of sway in Hill offices. I decided to write a popular book, in order to reach just a far broader range of people than I could with an academic article. You know, I had already written at this point enough articles for 10 years, so I was feeling rather secure. It's a shame, but in economics, you know, they don't really count books towards tenure. At most research universities, you know, a book might count as one article, but your chair would tell you absolutely don't do it. Versus if you're in kind of more open-minded disciplines like sociology, political science, books are completely welcome. You know, what's crazy about this is that when you go down the list of Nobel Prize-winning economists, they all write books. Now, why? Because they want to reach broader audiences with their ideas. They know that very few people are going to open up an esoteric economics journal and actually read their ideas. So, you know, household economist names from Paul Krugman to Joe Stiglitz and the likes, they all primarily write books to reach broad audiences. And I thought, you know, I want to reach broad audiences like Paul Krugman and Joe Stiglitz or now Stephanie Kelton. So I'm going to write a book. And, you know, I have to say it was an absolutely wonderful experience, challenging, but truly wonderful. I mean, to dedicate a year and a half of my time to just sit down and focus on one project and one project only, and really to have the space to deeply articulate my thoughts and ideas, to what I hope to be a very wide readership was an absolute joy. You know, while I was writing the book, my partner, was pregnant and I thankfully finished the book prior to having our child. But I really felt like I had two babies. I had the book and then I had, you know, my human kiddo that arrived at fairly similar times. So it was a true joy in both respects.
It's fascinating to know. I didn't realize that economists were disincentivized from writing books and publishing books. And that's interesting to know and makes it, I think, even more remarkable that you're going this direction. As you did so, did you have any models or figures in mind that you looked to as examples of like effective public communicators of affirmative economic messages?
That's a great question. So I kind of had two different sets of kind of people that influenced me in mind when I set out to write this book. And one was just like leaning on some of my favorite writers, largely out of the civil rights movement, both favorite writers and orators, people like A. Philip Randolph, Bayard Rustin, Martin Luther King, James Baldwin is just one of my all-time favorite writers. So I really spent a lot of time with his texts thinking about how were they relaying ideas? Because, you know, look, we have to be storytellers, I mean, to get ideas to stick. And ideas truly are one of the most powerful weapons that exists. But we need to think about how to effectively relay those ideas and embed them, you know, in people's minds, or at least get people to contend with them, which is really what I'm aiming to do, is just getting people to think about these ideas. You know, in the economic space, I absolutely, you know, spent quite a bit of time, you know, with a host of economist books and thinking about, you know, how is it that they laid out their arguments and how is it that they kind of relayed their messages to a diverse set of readers. And, you know, I have to say, folks like Milton Friedman and Friedrich Hayek were great writers. I mean, I truly do admire their ability to communicate complex and radical ideas to, you know, the voting public. And so I absolutely spent a lot of time, you know, reading their works and others and thinking about, you know, how to write an effective book. But here I have to say, you know, I'm also deeply in debt to one of my dear friends and editors, Jed Cohen, who, you know, he is an editor for Duke University Press, was one of my best friends during my 2 years at Duke and remains one of my closest friends. And he helped me through the writing process a good bit. Behind every good book is a good editor. And I think we need to acknowledge that quite openly, because books are always a collaborative process, even when they just have one author. You know, they have a whole host of people that help them make it to press and into your lap, hopefully on a nice, beautiful, sunny day while sitting outside and you know, kicking the feet up. And so, you know, it was really through, you know, my collaborative work with him that I was able to find my voice as a writer, because learning how to write journal articles, you know, earlier we were talking about the dissertation, is just very different from learning how to write a book for mass consumption.
Hear, hear. So the title of the book, to say it again, is The Ends of Freedom, Reclaiming America's Lost Promise of Economic Rights. But to get us into this argument, maybe you can unpack the title and talk a little bit about how you've structured the book in three parts.
Yeah. So, you know, let's talk about freedom a little bit. I think freedom is our most powerful and salient word in kind of our political discourse here in the United States. I mean, everybody declares for freedom. But in declaring for freedom, unfortunately, we often all mean different things. And it's what allows, you know, President Biden to launch his election campaign in the name of freedom. And it's what allows Ron DeSantis to launch his, also declaring to, he's seeking to make America more free. Although he has to do some serious twists and turns to come up with any, you know, real definition of freedom, given his set of policy priorities. So the ends of freedom really comes from the idea that the right has very effectively weaponized the idea of freedom to simply mean negative freedom, which is freedom from government, famously articulated in the Bill of Rights, coupled with access to markets. If only we have limited government plus access to markets, which, to be clear, requires government in the first place, then people will be free. But this really differs with kind of more holistic understandings of freedom, which also incorporate what the philosopher Isaiah Berlin deemed positive freedoms. Now, by positive freedoms, I mean freedom to certain things. Importantly, the freedom to the good life, Jefferson's promise, life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness, which is enshrined in the very ideals of this nation. And in order to actually be meaningfully free, people don't only need negative rights, they don't only need civil and political rights and reproductive rights, which are increasingly coming under attack, especially across conservative states, but they also need economic rights, these positive rights like things to, you know, the right to an education, the right to healthcare, the right to a home and the like. And what I try to do in the book is lay out, you know, an argument in the first third about first how it is that we got here. But I do that quite briefly, really kind of flipping the traditional book about neoliberalism on its head, as we talked about earlier. So I kind of briefly talk about how we got here and where here is, with 40 million Americans still in dire poverty, the same number of Americans that were in poverty when Johnson launched the war on poverty, or when President Roosevelt, at the height of the Great Depression, declared one third of Americans are ill-clad, ill-housed, and ill-fed. But it's also about the 100 million Americans that are just, you know, one emergency room visit, one layoff, one, you know, missed bill away from, you know, really severe economic hardship. And in that first third of the book, I lay out kind of these two contending visions for freedom. On the one hand, we have kind of the classic neoliberal vision of freedom, which is, as I mentioned earlier, you know, limited market, limited government plus access to markets, which was, you know, championed by people like Friedrich Hayek and Milton Friedman, and then, you know, brought into the political sphere by folks like Barry Goldwater and Ronald Reagan, but also adopted essentially hook, line, and sinker by the New Democrats, you know, starting really effectively with Jimmy Carter, who I would argue is the first neoliberal president before Reagan, but culminating in Bill Clinton's presidency, and certainly heavily influencing Barack Obama's. Then, you know, I talk about what I call America's other freedom, which is the fact that we've had this long march towards a more meaningful, robust notion of freedom, starting with the founders, folks like Thomas Paine and Alexander Hamilton, who advocated, you know, for a robust state that legislated in the public's interest, that ensured that all people had a share of the economic pie, not as a matter of charity, not as a matter of welfare, but as a matter of their citizenship right. And what's really fascinating, and this is fairly well connected to Jefferson's ideas of a landholding, you know, citizen right now, you know, of course we need to acknowledge that in the case of Jefferson and many others of the founders, they really envisioned a white male kind of ownership class. To be a citizen was largely to be a white and male and educated. But as we, you know, increasingly expand the notion of citizenry to be far more all-encompassing, we start to see that these economic rights championed by the founders and then later by people like President Abraham Lincoln, who tried to enshrine this into law with the Homestead Act, where he's redistributing land to people as a matter of right, really becomes a centerpiece of the vision for freedom in America. Yet it's language we've just lost here today. And I think that this language really came to its most, kind of powerful height during the civil rights era, where you have, leaders like Martin Luther King and others fighting not only for civil rights, but also for economic rights. When we learn about King today, we forget this, the radical side of King, that King not only championed the Voting Rights Act and Civil Rights Act, but after the passage of those two bills, he turned his attention full time to enshrining an economic bill of rights into law. In fact, his final piece of writing, which was published after his untimely assassination, was entitled We Need an Economic Bill of Rights, and was centering the Poor People's Campaign around the demands that I essentially outline here in the book: the right to a job, the right to housing, the right to education, and more. So in the last, in the bulk of the book is when I actually dive into these various economic rights. And in each chapter, for instance, the first chapter on the right to work, I try to do three things. I first briefly talk about the history and struggle for this right. A lot of the times we think about the right to a job or the right to healthcare, and we say, this Scandinavian country does it fairly well. And that's true, and we can learn a lot from them. But I think that there's also a lot lost in kind of pushing American history to the side. And so I try to rediscover and retell kind of the economic history in the US, where these rights in many instances have been fought for well over a century. The second thing I try to do is debunk kind of the common economic or neoliberal wisdom around why, say, providing people universal education is a terrible idea. Because I think, if we want to convince people of this idea, we need to talk about the criticism and explain kind of point by point on why it's just deeply misguided. And then third, I make the positive case for, the economic right in each given chapter. The final section of the book, which we can maybe talk a little bit later, kind of takes on what I like to call the $1 trillion question. Now, we might say, a right to a job and a right to housing is wonderful. And in fact, most Americans want it. We did popular polling with Data for Progress, and we found that 2/3 of Americans want an economic bill of rights, including a majority of independents and Republicans. But when the rubber hits the road, when it's time to pay for these things, that's when we might hit some serious speed bumps. And so I lay out a comprehensive argument of how is it that we finance an economic bill of rights?
Yeah. So, okay. This is probably going to happen if it hasn't happened already for you. You are going to find yourself in a situation where you're in, a conference hotel, and there are some Hill staffers over there, and this table is full of like Republican Hill staffers, and this table is full of like Democrat Hill staffers. I wonder how your pitch goes. Is it the same to each of those tables? Do you even bother with one or the other?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, at its core, the book is trying to offer us an agenda to attain freedom. It's trying to lay out a vision and a policy prescription that details, how is it that we restructure the economy to ensure that people have choices to be and do what they have reason to value, rather than to be stuck in this current economy that we've built that really, hamstrings human flourishing left and right, and really places people at the service of the economy rather than placing the economy at the service of us. Which, when we think about what the point of the economy is, the point of the economy is to ensure that we all get to lead meaningful and dignified lives, that we all have homes and food and, can go to school and get healthcare. Yet we've structured an economy that's essentially based on, the bastardized version of the game of Monopoly, which was, of course, originally a parody on capitalism. Yet, really, it's all about who can grab the most property and who can fill up their bank accounts the most. I mean, that's kind of the game of what that we've set up for ourselves. But instead, I want to kind of change the conversation. Instead of playing the game of Monopoly, I want us to play the game of life. Think about how do we structure that economy that dictates so much of our lives, right? I mean, Americans work 47 hours a week, often 50-ish weeks a year, thanks to our limited to no vacation. And, we're often working to 65 or well past that in order to make ends meet. And, you know, how is it that we structure that economy to actually, you know, kind of prioritize a decent life? I mean, it's funny, we always talk about living in a democracy and how important democratic values are. But why is it that democratic values, you know, stop when it comes to the door to the economy opening? It's like there's this massive gate we put up. And what I'm interested in doing is tearing down that gate between the democratic realm of politics and kind of the private realm of the economy, where you know, money is the only currency that matters rather than votes. And so when I talk with Hill staffers, you know, first of all, you know, unfortunately, I haven't had any excited, interested calls yet from Republican staffers, although I eagerly await them. You know, what I make the conversation about is about freedom and about realizing, you know, kind of the American promise, the promise to life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness, and the promise to be a truly free nation where people have meaningful choices, as Milton Friedman put it. People are actually free to choose. I mean, if you are, you know, graduate from college with $200,000 of debt, you're not free to choose much. You're free to choose the highest paying job to make sure you don't, you know, you are able to meet your bills. You know, if you have a kid and you have to send them to daycare to keep working, I mean, you're not free to choose much. You have to stick in your current job because that daycare bill is going to come due every month, no matter what. You know, if you're, you know, living in an apartment and you want to downsize because your apartment is eating up half of your take home pay, unfortunately, you're not free to choose a better paying job or a cheaper apartment. Because let me tell you, they just don't exist in most cities across the United States. So, you know, I think this notion that we're free to choose is a farce. And the question is, how do we build an economy that actually provides people some meaningful sense of freedom? And here, you know, when I talk about freedom, it's frustrating because I think what the word that always comes into my mind is enduring freedom. But I don't know if that brings up any bells for listeners here, but I don't know if that brings up any bells for listeners here, but that's actually the code name for the war in Afghanistan. You know, the right is just better. Oh, no, is right. The right is just far better at marketing, be it, you know, freedom, right to work, you know, you name it. They have kind of co-opted every powerful word in our political dialogue and, you know, turned it into something evil. So part of my mission here is also to not give up on freedom, but to reclaim it.
I think that project of reclaiming is, yeah, that's a kind of a common rhetorical move for heterodox economists arguing along the lines that you are for, you know, embracing, reclaiming, reanimating, rediscovering the kind of progressive roots of these ideas and the progressive elements of them. And I wonder along those lines, one of the things I like about your book is that you lean into and sort of try to pull back the idea of free to choose. We want to be free to choose. Yes, let's do that. And by that, you're sort of maybe offering a hand to those Republican staffers or opening up space for conversation. And then in the book, you also talk about, you highlight how Hayek, Friedrich Hayek, was not opposed to social welfare programs, healthcare programs, and that how that sort of gets left out. On that note, I wonder if you've thought about entitlement as maybe a rhetorical obstacle here. So I imagine that those Republican staffers might hear you say the right to or the freedom for and say, okay, you're talking about entitlements, which has become a sort of a demon term, right, over the last 40 years, over the neoliberal period. Do you have any clever way to get us into recovering entitlement as a kind of affirmative, positive, progressive trope or direction?
You know, look, I'm going to be honest. I think that most of, you know, the Republican members of Congress and staff on the Hill are largely a lost cause. I do not think that we're going to change many hearts and minds there. Now, that is very different from Republican voters. I do think that there is a tremendous opening to convince independent and Republican voters, as well as Democratic voters for that matter, that this is the type of vision that we need to be working towards. And those are the folks that I'm trying to capture more of. And you know, I don't focus much on entitlements. I agree that it is a challenging word, but what I like to talk about instead is what I call the well-being state. How do we, you know, move away from this notion of entitlements, this notion of welfare, to embrace a well-being state? And this is precisely why the policy prescriptions that I outline in the book are what I call targeted universalist policies. So they're universal policies, things like college for all that benefits everybody. You know, Hillary Clinton famously quipped that, you know, she wasn't for sending Donald Trump's kids to free college in the presidential primary back in 2016. And I explain why that's exactly wrong. You know, yeah, I'm fine with paying for Donald Trump's kids to go to college, as I am with paying for, you know, low-income students to go to college across the board. We have a great way to capture, you know, the income and wealth of high income earners, though I'm not so sure Donald Trump is one, through something called the progressive income tax. And we need to couple that, of course, with the progressive wealth tax. But rather than having these means tested gates at every, you know, through every program that are essentially just meant to make programs more complicated and in return kind of create political divides over them, what we need to do is have simple, straightforward, universal programs, things like Medicare for all, things like universal free college, and then, you know, tax the rich via income and wealth taxation and let the programs do their jobs. You know, poor programs for the poor make poor programs. It was this great quip by Wilbur Ross, one of the key architects of the New Deal and Great Society. And I think he was absolutely right. If we want broad-based buy-in to these types of programs, we need to ensure that they serve a broad swath of America, economically, racially, and geographically. And that's precisely what I aim to do in building this well-being state, where the state is there to ensure that, you know, we are all lifted up, that we all have a floor under our feet at all times. Kind of, you know, the vision is essentially to constrain the market, both using floors and ceilings to, you know, ensure that everybody is taken care of at a fairly high quality of life, but also that nobody is allowed to have undue economic power. And this is one of the things I talk about a lot when we think about, you know, taxing the rich. It's not only to create the economic space to, you know, ensure that we can, you know, fully afford everything we need to lead to a high quality of life for all people, but it's also because we need to, you know, effectively put an end to the oligarchy that we find ourselves in today by actually placing, you know, ceilings in the economy, saying that, you know, whether it be a maximum income or maximum wealth level, we're actually able to reclaim our economy and better entrench democratic processes into the economic realm, rather than just allowing, you know, the billionaires of the world to essentially be mini dictators.
So I'd like to invite you to speak to some of your particular proposals. You can speak to any of them, but I guess maybe to get us going, I'd like to hear about the chapter titled The Right to Housing and what you're proposing policy-wise for this to secure this right to housing.
So it's a great question. Slogans matter. And in fact, you know, slogans often, you know, are best at changing hearts and minds. And it was a particular slogan that actually set the initial seed for this book in my mind. And it was when I was spending time at Occupy Wall Street as a first year PhD student, where, you know, the rallying cry was an economy for the 99%. And it's a fine slogan, but they didn't have a 10-point plan. People love criticizing them for that. And, you know, I don't think that's a fair criticism. I think it's fine for a social movement to have a vision, but not necessarily articulate all the policies. And so, you know, I kept thinking an economy for the 99%, what does that look like? And that's largely what I try to articulate here in the book. And a right to housing, I think, is a good example of this, because it's a, you know, it's a nice slogan, but what does it really mean? And I had the wonderful privilege of working with a group called the Homes Guarantee Campaign and actually fleshing this out. So it's a group associated with the grassroots organization People's Action, where they brought together a whole host of, you know, housing advocates, people that were Section 8 voucher recipients, people who are either currently or previously unhoused, you know, elderly people struggling to make their bills. And they, you know, wanted to re-envision what a right to housing looked like. and kind of the grass tops leaders were, you know, selling them on expanding Section 8 vouchers or this or that. And they said, no, 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 we want a radical vision that would actually put an end to the homelessness and housing insecurity crisis here in America. And so they brought me in as the economist on that team and a number of other kind of academic policy experts that helped through a bottom-up policy development approach to flesh out what an actual right to housing looks like. And that's what this chapter is, you know, largely based on. And what I focus on in the chapter is kind of two key elements to this policy prescription. The first is rent control. Look, we have rent control for the vast majority of Americans already. It's called a 30-year mortgage, where we essentially freeze rent payments for 30 years, thanks to government policy, which created the 30-year mortgage out of whole cloth. Almost no other country has it. The United States did not have it before the New Deal, which essentially legislated it into existence. And that has led to the creation of the, you know, the wealth that exists today for the middle class. It's a beautiful, brilliant policy. But in creating that, we left out rent controls for the other half of Americans who rent. And in turn, what we've done is we've created a housing market that leaves renters at the whim of landlords. And I think this was on full display during the COVID-19 crisis, where in many cities, landlords were jacking up rent prices by 15, 18, in some cases, 23, 24% a year, thanks to the market power that they have. And it's not because they were investing in those apartments and making them better. It was because they simply could. And so what rent control does is, you know, takes the fact that both landlords and tenants both have rights to the housing, and it redistributes the bundle of rights that landlords disproportionately currently enjoy. And it says that tenants have a right to stay in their house, and it limits how much landlords can increase the rent by on an annual basis. And I argue for, you know, an increase in the order of magnitude of 3 to 5% per year as the absolute cap. Now, you know, that will help many existing tenants stay in their homes today. But what it won't do is, you know, help ensure that we have, you know, additional housing options given our lack of affordable housing that exists on the market in the first place. And to do that, you know, we need much more comprehensive reform. And I think one of the most crucial areas that we should be investing in today is by building millions of units of social housing. Vienna, Austria is, I think, you know, the key example here, where the majority of residents live in publicly owned social housing that serves, you know, a diverse set of stakeholders. It's mixed income housing, high quality housing. Many of these housing units have daycares in the bottom floor, have public swimming pools in their rooftops, have gorgeous community gardens. I mean, this is not the public housing that we think of here in America. This is truly high quality, beautiful luxuries, beautiful temples of public luxury. And, you know, we can have that here too, if only we will it to be the case. And through building such public housing, what we would do is actually set a real floor in the marketplace for rentals, because if a private landlord wasn't offering decent housing options, people could simply go to the public housing option and get a nice apartment at an affordable rent. And so it would fundamentally rebalance the housing market away from a nexus of profit towards a nexus of home and community.
Are there any other of the proposals that you feel like are especially, I mean, they're all important, but do any stand out to you as maybe, is there a sequence that you have in mind here for these rights being afforded, these freedoms being embraced and distributed? Is there an order of operations, or do we have a sense that, you know, we'll take what we can get when we can get it and figure it out accordingly?
You know, it's a great question. And I think later this summer, we will hopefully be having a resolution calling for an economic bill of rights introduced in the U.S. Congress, highlighting the fact that, you know, you can't take any one of these things in isolation, that, you know, if you actually want to deliver on economic rights, just like if you actually want to deliver on political rights, you can't just, you know, give one piece of the puzzle to voters and say, you know, good luck. We really ideally want to adopt the package together. That said, you know, sometimes in politics, you do need to prioritize. And for me, the two rights that really come to the fore are the right to a job and the right to a clean and healthy environment. And let me briefly explain why. The right to a job would fundamentally restructure the labor market, which is where the vast majority of us, you know, earn our paychecks to pay our rent and put food on our table on a week-to-week basis. And by implementing a right to a job, which I argue has three pillars, kind of running the economy hot, permanently expanding the public workforce, and finally, the almighty job guarantee to actually eradicate unemployment and poverty level wages once and for all. By implementing such a program, you would fundamentally restructure the power relations of the economy because workers would have a viable exit option. And they would actually be able to tell their bosses, F you, if they have a shitty boss, an abusive boss, an exploitative boss, as unfortunately so many people do. And it would provide them with a reasonable fallback position where they could get a well-paying job working for the government and contributing to improving society, to making us all better off. And that fundamental restructuring of the power relationship between employees and employers will have massive ripple effects throughout the economy. It will just fundamentally shift the dynamics of capitalism in crucial ways that I think are frequently underappreciated when we're talking about the job guarantee program. The second area is, you know, addressing the climate crisis. Unfortunately, we're dealing with this crisis in the here and now. It simply cannot wait. And so, you know, look, nobody has economic security on a burning planet. And if we don't start investing in ensuring a clean and healthy environment for current and future generations, then most of the conversation we're having here is rather mute. And so, you know, given the absolute necessity of the moment, I think that we need to do everything we can to pivot our economic activities away from, you know, extraction and, you know, fossil fuel consumption and towards a truly sustainable future that all of the evidence shows is both, you know, eminently reasonable, is affordable, and is completely achievable. It's simply political hurdles that stand in the way. It's really, how is it that we can neutralize the power of fossil capital in order to reorganize economic activity away from, you know, the current dirty, pollutive state that we live in and towards one of kind of green abundance?
You know, education is often thought of as being a kind of magical lever, you know, for class mobility, and we sort of reify it and extract it from the rest of our policy horizon and our policy imagination. But importantly for you, you're putting a right to education right in the heart of your economic bill of positive rights. And I'd like to hear you talk about the way you conceive of education within this, let's say, menu of policies.
Yeah, it's a great question. You know, the reason I prioritize the right to an education is kind of multifaceted. So in the economic realm, we often talk about how education provides people with more opportunities and also how education has a high return on investment and both pays off for the individual through higher future earnings, but it also pays off collectively. A more educated population, you know, means that we have a higher GDP across the board and higher living standards for the entire country. So, you know, in econ speak, there's positive externalities from a person, obtaining a higher education degree, so to say. And we've frequently thought of education as a silver bullet and really sold education to people as the key way for them to advance themselves. Well, there is one thing that education will guarantee you in America, and that is debt. But, you know, that's not because it needs to be the case. It's because we've made it the case. But you know, before I get into the debt question, let me just say there's a second argument for education. And sometimes I'm slightly uncomfortable with the first, though I do make it myself. And it's because, you know, the point of an education isn't just for economic advancement. It's not just, you know, for money. The point of an education is also to, you know, be a fuller human, to lead a more kind of enlightened, informed, an interested life. I mean, often the pursuit of knowledge is not out of, you know, does not come from the pursuit of money, but it's, you know, comes from the pursuit of passion and of interest. We are a deeply inquisitive species. And I think, you know, recognizing that there are huge benefits to us as individuals and society from promoting education from a social standpoint is really sometimes undervalued and thought of second to the economic benefits. And I think that's a mistake. I really do. And particularly when it comes to democracy, I mean, why is our democracy under threat? In part, it's because we do have a bit of an education problem and a kind of political literacy problem. And I, you know, will education solve all of these issues? Of course not. But do I think that, you know, education, reinvesting in our education system can help improve the very functioning of our democracy? Absolutely. And I think that that's something that we need to think much more deeply about. So, you know, given these kind of multiple benefits to education, I prioritize the right to an education in the book and talk about how we can and must expand it. I mean, right now, it's the right in the book that actually people are most familiar with. We have a right to a K-12 education enshrined in most state constitutions. But what's fascinating here is that we didn't always have the right, say, to high school. Indeed, in the early 20th century, the high school movement, a grassroots movement that pushed to expand the right to education past primary school, was able to successfully get the right to high school for the American people that we so enjoy here today. And what's funny about it is that the arguments made against free college were essentially the exact same arguments made hook, line, and sinker against free high school, you know, 100, 110 years ago. You know, it's too expensive. It'll disproportionately benefit the rich because the rich are the ones who are getting high school degrees in the first place. Well, why were the rich getting high school degrees then? And why are the rich getting, you know, college degrees now? It's because they have access to them. Once you open it up to the masses, you see that low-income people and, go for these degrees just as frequently as high-income people do. It's the fact that education is serving as a barrier in the first place. And by making it a right, we tear down that barrier. And so I think if we want people to be truly free, if we want them to have, you know, the opportunities truly available to them, I think that we need to provide them with a high quality education for them to think about what does it mean to be free in the first place? And for them to think about, you know, what is the life that they want to lead? What do they want to do with their life, with their time? I mean, time, we talk about valuable resources. We're often talking about money, but really time is the most valuable resource we have. And I think an education allows people to think about how to spend their time and to what ends. Now, one thing I do want to add here is I don't necessarily think college is the right path for everybody. I think it should be available to everybody, but I by no means do I think that a college degree, a four-year degree, should be a prerequisite for a high-quality life. And, you know, one other thing that I don't discuss enough in the book is the role of things like trade schools and kind of other avenues that we also need to invest much more in today. And it's not only about investing in those avenues, things like trade schools, but it's also in kind of changing the ethos around them. Today we have, I think, a stigma to a degree around the trades and really prioritizing four-year, you know, bachelor's degrees. And I think that's a little bit of a mistake. I think that, you know, yes, college can and should be open to all, but I also think that we should recognize that not everybody needs to go to college and that college should not be a prerequisite for leading a high quality life.
And there are a lot of problems with colleges that would surely be solved or could be solved as we're dealing with this question of an education and a freer, more democratic democracy, I think, here in the United States. You talked about education as a path to greater political literacy. And I think one of the interesting things about being in the kind of heterodox wing of political economy is the kind of stark realization that financial literacy is actually at the same time as important, I believe, right? And this relates to chapter 10, how do we pay for it? I'm not talking about financial literacy in terms of balancing your checkbook. I'm talking about financial literacy in terms of what is money? How does it work? Where does it come from? And that sort of thing. So let's go back to that dimly lit DC bar where we're at a table with five Democrat, you know, Hill staffers, ordered like a fifth round. They're really into what you're saying. And they say, this all sounds really great, Dr. Paul, but how are we going to pay for it? first of all, do you expect that that will be the question? It, like, there's been a lot of gains, I think, in kind of making that question itself questionable. Certainly still prevails, I think, in policy circles or in policy discussions, at least in the macro level. But in this scene, in this ideal scenario where you're talking to your ideal audience, A, do you anticipate bumping into that question? And B, you know, to kind of close out our conversation of your book, as you do close out the book, what's the answer?
So yes, I do anticipate the question. You know, I think that we have made huge advances, often thanks to the work of, you know, modern monetary theorists, in really advancing the conversation around debt and deficits and the like. But I think as the recent debt ceiling fight that played out in Washington demonstrates, you know, people still care a tremendous amount about debt. They still misunderstand debt by a huge degree. And they, you know, they still are going to bring this up at every single turn. And so we need to talk about the $1 trillion question. But when we do it, we need to break it up into two questions. When we ask, how are you going to pay for it? You're really asking two questions. The first question is, where will the money come from, the dollars and cents? And the second question, and I contend the more complicated question that deserves far more attention, is where will the real resources come from? You know, in the case of Medicare for All, where are the MRI machines and the anesthesiologists and the nurses and the hospital staff going to actually come from? And that is the question that I think we need to be paying far more attention to today. The dollars and cents is the easy part. Let me briefly explain why. So, you know, first of all, you know, there is a tremendous amount of space for us to increase our national debt. As John Maynard Keynes famously said, anything we can actually do, we can afford. Now, the first half of that question, anything we can actually do, gets to my second question, that where will the real resources come from? But if we can do it, we can indeed afford it. So, you know, part one, let's increase the national debt and let's do so substantially. There's plenty of economic headroom to do so, particularly when we're investing in the American people themselves. Things like education, housing, healthcare, these all are investments that pay enduring benefits. You know, that's very different from, say, straight upward redistribution that, you know, for example, the TCJA undertook, which is, you know, a very different type of growing the national debt that doesn't necessarily pay enduring benefits for years to come. In fact, I would argue that it you know, makes us all worse off. So, you know, the second thing is, I do think that we are going to need broad-based taxation. And I use the example of Medicare for All as one example. So I have a good job. I am a tenure-track professor at a, you know, major public university. Yet here I pay $830 a month for my health insurance. That doesn't even count my co-pays or my deductibles. Now, under a Medicare for All type program, if I were to have to pay $500 a year, under a Medicare for All type program, if I were to have to pay $500 a month more in taxes and then have access to, you know, Medicare for All, I would not only have better insurance and, you know, one insurance for the rest of my life, I'll add, I actually counted it up the other day. I've changed insurances 13 times since I've been an adult. But I would actually be saving money. I wouldn't have to pay that $830 a month to my insurance company any longer. Yes, my tax bill would go up a little bit, but in fact, I'd have more money in my pocket at the end of the day and superior health insurance. So I think we need to move away from thinking of taxes exclusively as toxic and to embrace a different language that, you know, really demonstrates, you know, to the American people that, you know, there are two sides of the equation. There's public taxation, and then there's also public benefits that exist. And I think that's really undervalued. You know, the third area, you know, that we could ensure that this is fully financed is particularly high taxes on the wealthy. Now, I want to talk about this in two different ways. First of all, taxes on the rich would create additional economic space if we needed it, if the economy was kind of running at full capacity and needed more space. But, you know, also, I think that taxes on the rich have the additional very important benefit of being what economists call, I'm going to get a little wonky here, Pigouvian taxes. Pigouvian taxes are taxes on social harms, things like, you know, often that's thought of as taxes on pollution, taxes on cigarettes or alcohol. Well, guess what? The rich are a social harm too. And so when we talk about taxing the rich, it's not only to create more economic space, but it's also about controlling the undue economic and political power that they have thanks to the wealth that they've accumulated through, you know, the rigged rules of the game. And so I think that is a fundamental aspect. Now, you know, the real resources, that truly is the challenge. In many instances, you know, this is going to take a lot more government planning than exists here today. I think that this is one of the primary challenges that we face, that we have essentially neutered the government for decades. We've been defunding the government. We've been, you know, outsourcing government work to places like McKinsey. And government capacity today, you know, doesn't exist to stand up an incredibly robust state on a dime. And so we need to reinvest in government capacity in order to ensure that, you know, our transition towards, be it, you know, a sustainable economy that's relying on 100% clean and renewable energy or a college for all type program runs smoothly. And I do think that that's going to take some serious time and attention to accomplish.
Well, Mark Paul, thanks so much for joining us. Everybody should run out and buy your new book, The Ends of Freedom, Reclaiming America's Lost Promise of Economic Rights. And thanks so much for joining us.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks for taking the time.